Welcome, everyone, to the seventh live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name's Tammy Simon. I'm the founder of Sounds True, and I'll be your host for this session. In this session, Dan Siegel will be teaching on mind, a journey to the heart of being human. Dan's broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., while I and the Sounds True team are all here in our Boulder studio. Please note that a free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours, and if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now it's my joy and my honor to introduce you to someone who is a friend of Sounds True's and a friend of mine, Dr. Dan Siegel. Dan is a New York Times bestselling author and the founding editor of the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, and he's executive director of the MindSight Institute. That's the MindSight Institute. Dan, welcome to the Neuroscience Training Summit, and thank you so much for taking the time out of what I know is a very busy schedule to come and broadcast live with us.
Thanks, Tammy. It's great to be here with you and to participate in Sounds True Neuroscience Summit. And I look forward to connecting with everyone who's listening in the Q&A and discussion with Tammy Simon. First, let me just thank Tammy for all your leadership and really bringing the worlds of spirituality and the world of science together. I think it's a really important moment in our human evolution. And to do that, in this hour, we're going to dive into what I hope will be relevant for you listening to this, that is the question of what the mind is. So people can use the term mind in all sorts of ways. And what we're going to do in this time together is explore various aspects of that. So if we just put up the first slide, the title slide, you'll see we're having mind, a journey that we're going to go on to the heart of being human. And what I'd like to offer to you is that the word mind, while many people usually refer to mind as a kind of symbol for thought, that is not at all what I'm using the word mind for. It includes thinking, of course, but it also includes feeling. It includes a sense of your subjective feeling of being either connected to a larger world, which some people might use the word spiritual connection. It includes feeling the sense of isolation, if that's what your experience is. It can include anything that is your internal subjective sense and how it relates to your external connections and even your internal connections to memory and autobiographical narrative and beliefs and all sorts of things. So to begin, as we go on this journey together, I'm using the mind for the sense of the heart of being human, what it really means to be a person on the planet. So when we go to the next slide, we can see that there is a set of interrogatives. And as we go through this hour together, we're going to look at these six basic ways that you're familiar with about the who, the what, the where, the when, the how, and why of you, of your mind. And you might even say of the mind in general. So we're going to go through this always looking at layers of experience that help answer these six questions. And one layer that we talk about in science is subjective experience. So we're going to refer to the fact that mental life has as part of it this notion of subjectivity, and we explore that through reflection. And there's no way of getting around that. When you report to me your what's called first person experience in science, we call that second person data. In other words, you're telling me your first person revelations and sensations, your subjective inner felt experience, you're reporting that to me. And in the reporting, you're translating into what I as a scientist would say is second person data. Doesn't second make it less? It just makes it a step removed from the first person experience you had. And there's no way around that. For you to communicate it to me, it's got to be translated in some way. It's not the thing itself. It's a translation. And that's the best we can do, which is fine. That's called second person data. Then we have the next layer, which is we accumulate, you know, let's say there's 1,000 people in the room and we get everybody's journal writings, you know, so they had an experience, that's first person. They wrote it down to communicate to us, that's second person. And then we do some statistical analysis on 1,000 people said this and that and that. And then we have now third person data. It's objective, if you will, scientific correlations, patterns across many individual subjects. So in science, you know, we generally work with third person information. That's kind of what we do. We try to measure it if possible, do statistical analyses on it, and that's all fine. If we're in anthropology, we might not even do statistics. We might just really carefully observe the second person data we get and then try to look at patterns across cultures, and that would be third person data. So you don't absolutely need measurement and statistics for science, but you do need careful observation. So I say all that because as we go through these interrogatives, we're going to actually try to weave together first, second, and third person information, all of it valid, each of it distinct, to try to say, who are we, what are we, where are we, when are we, how do we work, and why are we here? All in an hour. So put on your seatbelts and let's get going. We're going to come back to these questions soon, but on the next slide, what you'll see is this idea of a triangle of human experience. And in this triangle, you have a really simple way of visually depicting the kinds of questions you and I are going to explore to look at this set of interrogatives. And it's really a simple question: what connects relationships, mind, and the brain in its body? And I say that because, you know, a lot of people, especially in science, love to talk about the brain. This is a neuroscience summit. But one of the first points I'm going to raise with you right now is that while I love neuroscience, I've loved it since I was in college, when I was in medical school, my neuroscience teacher actually won the Nobel Prize for discovering how experience shapes the circuitry of the brain, David Hubel. So we were all excited, and he was a wonderful teacher, and I couldn't love neuroscience more. What I'm going to say to you here may be a little agitating for some neuroscience folks and even some clinicians, but I'm going to say this, that let's keep an open mind about whether the mind is actually the same as brain activity. So a standard view would say, well, on this triangle, mind is simply a synonym for the activity of the brain. And sometimes people say, yeah, the brain is the hardware, the mind is the software, or something like that. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that while Hippocrates, the grandfather of modern medicine, said that 2,500 years ago, and William James in 1890, the grandfather of the field of modern psychology, reaffirmed that the mind is simply the activity of the brain, what I'm going to suggest to you is that that view may be just a part of a much bigger story. And that's the story we're going to dive into right now. Looking at this triangle begins that story, begins that journey that says, look, if you say the mind is including your feelings, your thoughts, your hopes, your dreams, your memories, your longings, your desires, even coming down to perceptions, and I say to you, well, what shapes that? And you say, well, my brain shapes it. And if I get drunk the night before, if I get a hit on the head, or if I'm really starving, all those mental activities, feelings, thoughts, things like that, I use the word SIFT, sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts as a fun acronym to remember at a minimum. That's what we mean when we're talking about the mind, sifting the mind, sensations, S, images, I, F, feelings, thoughts, T. So when we sift the mind, you say, well, I got a hit on my head, I'm drunk, or I'm starving. All those things will change how the sifting process happens. Your mental activities will change. And that's what Hippocrates said in a book called On the Sacred Disease. When people have epilepsy, of course, all those things are changing. But the first thing to say about that is we can show that if we affect the biome in your intestines, the bacteria and other organisms that are living in your gastrointestinal system, your intestines, we can show it'll affect your brain and affect all those sifting things. So why exclude the body from whatever this thing that's shaping mind is all about? And even more than affecting the brain's activity, there may be a fundamental way where mind is actually emerging from the whole body. So this point is that by putting the mind in the world as a synonym for brain activity, maybe actually limiting our understanding of mental life. Now, I understand that over 95% of my academic peers would say, that's ridiculous, Dan. We know that the mind is just brain activity. And I've had people who yell and scream at me in lectures in the back of the room. They'll get up and say, this triangle is making science go backwards. But what I'm suggesting is that for 2,500 years, science may have been just looking at a small part of a larger story and doing it with so much conviction that everybody around it kind of starts praying to the neuroscience gods, when instead the mind may be only in part emerging from the brain. So the first thing we're saying is on this body thing is it might be including the body as well. So let's keep that in mind. Second part of this triangle there, besides mind now, and we've done embodied brain, the brain is in a body, is relationships. If I said to you, someone you love was really, really mad at you, well, would that affect your sifting? It would affect your sensations. It would affect the images you have, the feelings you have, the thoughts you have. You know, and you can show, I'm an attachment researcher, when we study how infants interact with their parents, we can show all that sifting process is massively changed by relationships. So as much as the body affects mental life, so do relationships. So years ago, that struck me as an important grounding place for the mind, that the mind isn't just occurring in the skull, it's occurring in the skin encased body, fine. That extends the mind beyond the skull, which is something really important to try to do. It's an embodied mind. But it's also a relational mind. It's embedded in our social connections and even our connections with relationships beyond just people. That is, relationships with nature, relationships with a higher spiritual sense of connection to meaning and purpose. Some people call it spiritual life. Or even if you believe in a God, you would say your theistic beliefs would be a part of your relationality, and that's fine. So that's what we mean by relationships, not just relationships with other people, but anything, let's call it your body, outside your skin and case body. So it's embodied and it's relational, this whole process of mind. That's the suggestion. But if we say that, then it still leaves us with a big question of what is the mind? And on the next slide, you'll see this proposal that there are at least four facets of mind. We've already touched on one of them, subjective experience. Right? It's the felt texture of lived life that cannot be reduced to just brain activity or even body activity or maybe even relational activity. It is what's called, I think, this is my suggestion, an emergent property. So if you think about the last slide, our suggestion is what connects those three things on that triangle of human experience is energy and information flow. And I mean energy in the strict physics notion of energy. Light energy, sound energy, electrical energy, okay, chemical energy. All these are literally parts of physics. You can study them quantitatively in science and physics. So it's energy in its absolutely scientifically grounded form, even though a lot of people who study the mind never use the concept of energy. For me, I couldn't help myself to try to go further from that triangle answering the question without the notion of energy. So energy flow is what the brain is all about, electrochemical energy flow. And when it symbolizes something, we call that a neural representation because that's how we create information. It's a pattern of energy with symbolic value. That's the word information. So we have a phrase, energy and information, because it changes, we can use the word flow. So that's our phrase. Energy and information flow answers the question of the prior slide, what connects these things? Now, when you look at where that energy and information flow is happening, you realize it happens in the skull for sure. In fact, that basically summarizes essentially all of neuroscience, patterns of energy and information flow, and you can get into the details, and that's exciting, but its larger view is that's what it's about. When I study attachment relationships, it's about energy and information flow sharing. And so what we're going to say is maybe the mind is some kind of emergent property, which is a mathematical term. When you look at systems, you realize that, let's say, water molecules, you know, you have hydrogen and oxygen. Okay, those get together as basic elements, and they themselves are composed of electrons and protons and neutrons and all that stuff we don't need to worry about. But when two hydrogens and oxygen get together, those are separate elements. They form H2O. Now, you couldn't explain the oceans and the cycle of evaporation and then condensation and then the whole water cycle that allowed life on Earth to grow and develop and evolve without the larger emergent properties of water. You can't reduce that whole water system to just hydrogen and oxygen. So an emergent property is a mathematical phrase. It's a property that comes from systems analysis of mathematics. I want to just repeat it. Emergent properties are a mathematically ascertained aspect of reality. They're not a guess. It's not a hypothesis. Emergent properties exist, like the movement of clouds cannot be explained by a single hydrogen and its connection to a single oxygen. You add another hydrogen, you get H2O. You got to have all the elements work together so that the sum is greater. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, right? That's what an emergent property is. Okay, so when we come now to this slide, what we're proposing is that energy and information flow happens inside your body, including your skull. So the brain activity is cool. What happens in your body is part of it. And then it's what happens between you and your connections to things outside of the body, other people and the whole planet. Let's just leave it at that. The proposal here is that there are four facets that may be emergent properties of energy and information flow. That's what this slide is. Subjective experience is one. It may be what's called a prime or something that cannot be reduced to the fundamental elements. It's an emergent property. Consciousness, we'll talk about a lot very soon. But consciousness is where you know that you're having a subjective experience. Information processing is part of what we're proposing is an aspect of, by definition, energy and information flow. Information flow is what information processing is. But then there's this fourth facet we haven't touched on at all yet, and that is self-organization. Now, this proposal gets a little weird, so put on your seatbelts. Because what I'm going to suggest to you is that the mind, which has at least these four facets, kind of like a diamond, four facets to it, has this self-organizational process that profoundly changes how we understand what a healthy mind is. So if we go to the next slide, you'll see here's the proposal. Relationships are the sharing of energy and information flow. Brain is the embodied mechanism that flow, that term. You can use the word embodied brain if you like that better. And here's our definition of this other facet of mind besides subjective experience, consciousness, and information processing. Let's put those to the side for now. But a fourth facet of mind is this notion that complex systems, which are systems that have properties of being capable of being chaotic, they're open systems, and they're nonlinear, meaning small input can lead to a large and difficult to predict result. Those three properties, chaos capable, open, and nonlinear, in mathematics, get you into the category of what's called a complex system. So that's just math. When you think about your life, would you say that you're capable of being chaotic? I know I certainly am. Would you say you are open to influences from outside of, let's put quotes around it, yourself? I know I certainly am. And what about nonlinear? Do you find if something happens in the morning that you didn't predict, even though it's small, it can lead to large and difficult to predict results? Well, if you've answered those three things, especially the third one, as yes, well then, welcome to the club. You are a complex system. Now, if you believe in mathematics, I mean, it's a branch of science, but if you ascribe to mathematics, let's just put it that way, doesn't matter whether you believe it or not, if you look at the properties of mathematics, you can say that in our universe, complex systems have, number one, emergent properties. And one of those emergent properties, number two, is self-organization. So this isn't just some California guy offering you some feel-good word, self-organization, yeah, yeah, la-di-da, let's have a campfire. I love campfires, and I actually love doing group singing and dancing and all sorts of things. But here's the deal. Complex systems have self-organizing properties, and they are completely counterintuitive. So if we look at this slide, then what we're saying, what's counterintuitive about the proposal of something being both within you and between you, one thing, is that we tend to have a model that, you know, we own our mind like it's something equivalent to brain activity, or it's something that comes from a skin encased body that defines the self. But what we're about to see is that it may in fact be that the mind is broader than the brain, and that the self, which emerges from the mind, is bigger than the body. So when we take a deep breath and say, well, that is completely ridiculous, that doesn't make any sense, you can kind of understand why nobody really, in science anyway, talks like this. So when we look at the bottom of the slide here, the parentheses, you're going to see that, in fact, what's counterintuitive about it is this. You've got a self, first of all, you've got an emergent property, which some scientists don't like to talk about, but it's a mathematical aspect of reality. Like, just think about water. You can't reduce the properties of the ocean to the properties of a hydrogen and the properties of an oxygen. You just can't do it. There's an emergent property of those of that water, of the waves, of the condensation, evaporation, et cetera. So that's an example of an emergent property. What I'm saying is the mind is an emergent property of energy and information flow, and that one of those properties we're going to propose is self-organization, okay? And self-organization is counterintuitive because here's the really weird thing about it. It is arising from something. That's the emergent aspect. It is then turning back and regulating that thing. So that's the self-organizing part. But what that means is that it is now regulating that from which it arose. And then, here's the weird thing, it continues to emerge from, arise from, that which it has already now regulated. So it's shaping its own becoming. And this is where we get the sense that the mind sometimes has a mind of its own. And just keep that in mind as you reflect on your own life, your first person experience, as we go forward. But this is the idea of it. It's an emergent property that arises from interactions of elements of a complex system, and it is turning back and regulating that from which it arose. Now, when we go to the next slide, we can see that you can participate in and also experience at the same time this energy shifting. And you can just remember how you do that with the acronym CLIF. You can modify contours of energy, the location of it, you know, where it's coming from, the intensity, the amplitude and density, and this can has to do with different forms and stuff, the frequency and the form, like that. You can do all sorts of things with energy. There's all sorts of ways of modifying the CLIF of energy. When we go to the next slide, you can see that when you think about things like this, you can actually understand why the developmental research shows when you have this capacity called, I call MindSight, the capacity to sense energy and information flow within and between. The within is called insight. It allows you to connect across past, present, future. Empathy is just a general word for sensing the inner life of another. And then when you honor differences and promote linkages, that's called integration. That's the third component of MindSight. So there's differences, let's say, in racial backgrounds, religious backgrounds, gender or lack of gender, sexual orientation. There's all sorts of beliefs we have. There's all sorts of ways we're different from each other. And that's fantastic. From a MindSight point of view, you want to honor differences. In fact, you thrive on differences and you cultivate compassion and kindness, which are the outcome of integration. So this is what mindset includes: insight, empathy, and integration, which gives rise to kindness and compassion. Now, on the next slide, you're going to see this really wild proposal, which is that if you ask the question, how do I optimize self-organization? It turns out that math doesn't use the word integration in this way, but it mathematics complex systems say that you optimize self-organization by linking differentiated parts. Differentiation means allowing to be separate, nurturing separateness. Not only separateness like disconnection, I mean unique, authentic development of, let's say, hearing from seeing, just as an example of perceptual systems. And then you link them together as a larger whole. So integration, the way we're using it, math doesn't use that word that way. They don't have a name for the differentiation and then linkage of those parts that they say is what optimizes self-organization. But we're just going to name that integration because math doesn't have a name for it. And amazingly, if you go to the next slide, you can say that integration, that central flow of a kind of river, has the qualities of FACES. It's not on the slide, but it's an acronym that stands for what math says comes from linking differentiated parts. It's F, flexible. It's A, adaptive. C is the math term coherence, which really means sticking well together flexibly over time, which really is a way of describing mathematically resilience. So that's coherence. E is energized, like having vitality. And S is stable, and I don't mean like stable for being stuck. I mean stable meaning you have equanimity. You can come back to baseline easily. So you've got flexibility, adaptability, coherence, energy, and stability. Now, amazingly, when you're not in integration, you move either to chaos, rigidity, or both. And this is just the math of complex systems. So here's the proposal I'm going to make to you on the next slide. These are the basic principles that come from this view. And in a neuroscience summit, I want to emphasize we are not pushing away brain studies. We're actually inviting them in, as you'll see. And our view is that the mind, this one facet of the mind, is viewed as a self-organizing emergent property or process that regulates energy information flow. Number two, harmony and health emerge from integration, the linkage of differentiated elements of a system. And you can say that where does that occur? The mind is both embodied and relational. And as we said, when that doesn't happen, you get chaos or rigidity. And amazingly, you can teach this because regulation is quite simple. You need to monitor something, which means being able to sense and predict aspects of it. And modifying something means shifting that thing, modulating it. And in this case, we're saying you're going to modify toward integration. You're going to monitor with more stability. And those are all teachable skills that I think, for example, mindfulness training does. Now, on the next slide, you can see as a therapist, for example, or a parent, or a teacher, or just a citizen on the planet, this simple view says we can strengthen the mind by enhancing regulation. It comes down to this incredibly simple formula: strengthen monitoring, develop the skill of modulating toward integration. And there are 9 domains of integration that you can explore. We're going to only explore 1 today, consciousness, but when you do this, it's remarkable how powerful the paradigm is for people to access very simply. So what I'm going to do now is just review kind of in an overview kind of way what this framework does for us. On the next slide, you can sort of see this idea that people are talking about, presence and mindful awareness. And they're not exactly the same thing, but you can see we just had a 3-day conference where I brought in all the different major researchers in mindful awareness, and we explored it from a number of different angles, clinical applications, and things like that. Is our annual interpersonal neurobiology conference, and this is basically an event where interpersonal neurobiology is the field where we combine all the different disciplines together. So it's not the same as the field of social neuroscience, which is a beautiful field that's a part of neuroscience, which is a part of biology. Instead, interpersonal neurobiology, the field I work in, is basically asking the question, what would happen if you combine all the fields of knowledge into one framework? So that's interpersonal neurobiology. And from our point of view, then we see, for example, how the mind can change the molecules of the body, which people in the past would say that's a little wild, a statement, but in fact, we now have the evidence. So here it is, you know, and here's what some people use as terms. There is no absolutely universal accepted definition of mindfulness. People often quote Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, a form of awareness that comes from paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally in the present moment. Jon, these days, when he and I have talked together recently, you know, he'll call mindfulness relationality, which, as you'll see, fits in with a lot of the new science from various disciplines. Jon has that term. You know, Trudy Goodman Cornfield and Jack Cornfield call this mindful awareness loving awareness. And Shauna Shapiro uses the phrase kind attention. And these things basically are focusing attention on intention, awareness of awareness itself. It's a way of training the mind. And I think they're basically integrative in the following way. You're differentiating sensory awareness from the observing, narrating awareness and linking them with attentional practice. And there's a phrase you can say, where attention goes, neural firing flows and neural connection grows. So to put that very simply, where attention goes is practice. So repeated practice, 15, 20 minutes a day, for example. Where that practice happens, you're creating a state. So where attention goes, neural firing flows. Neural firing flowing creates a state of mind, if you will. It participates in the creation of this state. So where attention goes, practice, neural firing flows, that's a state. With repeated activation of a state, states become traits by way of neuroplasticity, and that's how neural connection grows. So that's a trait. You want to create a trait in your life, let's say, of being integrated. That would be a trait you could create. So this is just taking this one example of a beautiful field and applying these principles to it. On the next slide, you can see how research has demonstrated from these researchers you see on here. The brain becomes more integrated. That's your elevator speech for what does mindfulness practice do to the brain? It literally becomes more integrated. The immune system becomes more robust. Sense of well-being is improved. Burnout for clinicians is decreased. Attention is enhanced. Relational function and empathy are improved. Epigenetic regulation to try to prevent inflammation is enhanced. Telomerase levels are optimized to repair the ends of your chromosomes. So these are established findings, and we could put on here also cardiovascular function is improved as well. So this is quite remarkable that what you do with your mind changes the functions of your body, literally changes molecules that, like enzymes, telomerase, that maintain the health of your cells. Molecules that sit on top of DNA and help prevent inflammation. I'm not making this stuff up. I'm not just like waving my flag and I did all these studies. These are other researchers. Many of them were at our meeting that we just had. And, you know, to see their work, you just cry because, you know, we've been, I think, having a feeling about this in various wisdom traditions for a long time. And now we have the science that's sort of caught up. But, you know, we now know the details. So it's really exciting to see this blending of reflective practice of the mind with physiological and molecular changes of the body. It's quite amazing. On the next slide, you're going to see some mind-blowing summaries of research that when my interns and I were revising a couple books or making a new book, you know, it was like, oh my gosh, but here's the finding. In October 2015, the Human Connectome Project, when they looked for every measure of well-being they could measure and looked for every measure in the brain they could assess, they found one brain condition predicted every measure of well-being they could find. And that is how interconnected the connectome was, which means how linked the differentiated regions were, was the best predictor of health. So, you know, this supports the earlier proposal from 1992 that integration is the basis of health. And then now, you know, two dozen years later, we have the technology advanced so you can actually study that in hundreds and hundreds of people and demonstrate that right as of now, the best predictor of well-being is how integrated your brain is. Now, when you compare that to point number two, let's say psychiatric disorders, let's start with ones not caused by what parents do. So there are disorders that we have, psychiatric disorders like people with schizophrenia or autism, not caused by what parents do at all. People with bipolar disorder, manic depressive illness, not caused by what parents do. The brain of those individuals, each study, and I'm talking about the work of Marcus Raichel at the University of Washington, St. Louis, and Hilary Bloomberg at Yale, have demonstrated, for example, impaired integration of the brain in all those conditions. And then let's now go to psychiatric conditions which are not related to just spontaneously generated, we don't know the reasons, basically, disorders, but what parents do, like severe abuse or neglect, which are basically called developmental trauma. So these are documented cases where parents have done really non-integrative things, is how I think of it as an attachment researcher. They've intruded on their child with abuse. It's too much linkage, not enough differentiation, or they have basically given too much differentiation, not enough linkage, that's neglect. And in that case, you also see, this is the work of Marty Teicher at Harvard University, you see impaired integration of the brain. Now, we'll go over parts of the brain soon, just explore what that means, but just leave it at that for this slide. And what's important about impaired integration in the brain is, and this, my interns and I couldn't believe this, but every mechanism of regulation that we could look for, and I told them, I want you to prove these ideas are wrong, and not just cherry pick and find one piece of data that supports it, find one piece of data that goes against it. And they thought I was kind of nuts, but that's the way you do science. You have to try to look for the opposite of what you're suggesting is true. So you're not just picking your data just to support a hypothesis. We couldn't find a single piece of evidence to go against the following statement, number three, that neural integration is the essential mechanism beneath the regulation of anything we could look for: mood, emotion, thought, attention, behavior, relationships, and morality. You need to have differentiated areas that are linked. And then here's the proposal, that's why I have the question marks there, by, you know, here's our proposal. Integrated relationships lead to the growth of neural integration, and these two things are what create well-being. So that's the whole model right there in one slide. Now, if you go to the next slide on the brain, let me just say this very briefly. You know, the brain has a lot of cells in it. You probably heard about that from other people. The thing I emphasize is that it's a system, and the system has differentiated areas. These differentiated areas have names. The names can be things you either like or don't like. But the biggest issue for anyone, I think, in a neuroscience summit would be to say, not where does something happen in the brain, but how. And the how is that this brain is a complex system itself with differentiated areas that then need to communicate with each other. The modern view of that is called the connectome. And so by looking at both the structural and functional aspects of connectivity, you can actually establish degrees of integration, right? So some of the classic areas that are integrative are the corpus callosum, which links the left and right, the hippocampus, which connects widely separated areas to each other, the prefrontal region there in the front, which is linking the top, the middle, and the bottom, and even the social world. And then you also have the overall study of the connectome. So these are four ways. So here's something that blew my mind when I heard it. Here we go. Those are the areas that are not integrative in those different disorders I mentioned. So let's take, for example, developmental trauma. Each of those four areas, the connectome overall, the corpus callosum linking left and right, the hippocampus, and the prefrontal region, are not linking to differentiated areas as well as they are in people who haven't been subject to neglect or abuse. And amazingly, if you say, what does mindfulness improve? Mindfulness improves those very same areas. It's kind of amazing. But that's just what the research shows. So integration, if we go to the next slide, you know, has all these aspects to it, right? And let's just punch the button as we go. So you can see, we'll go one by one. There's 9 points. It's body regulation, it's attuned communication, It's emotional balance. It's extinguishing fear. It's flexibility. It's insight into oneself that connects past, present, future. It's morality and it's intuition. And this list is a remarkable list that comes from working with someone who injured this one of the major integrative areas. But the amazing thing is my field, attachment, we can show that secure attachment is, we believe, responsible for creating the first eight of these nine. And no one's just looked at intuition yet. And amazingly, mindfulness increases all nine. So in a way, what mindful awareness practice does is grow the integrative fibers of the brain that are, as far as we can tell, essentially identical to the relational experience of integration that produces these same, at least the first eight of the nine, based on research. This is a remarkable, what's called consilient finding. If we go to the next slide, we can see that, you know, there's all sorts of ways in the different books I've written, you know, about exploring integration. So it's not just left and right integration, that's bilateral you see there, but there are lots of ones. I'm not gonna get into them now because of time, but in consciousness integration, we're gonna explore some of the details there that I think are incredibly exciting right now. So with my patients who are in the office, you can go to the next slide to this wheel of awareness. There was actually a table that looks exactly like this that's now in the Mindsight Institute. But when I had a private separate office for seeing clients, seeing patients, I would stand them up and bring them around the table. And I'd say, okay, you know, here's the proposal. I would say to my patients, I'd say, look, you know, it looks like the mind is a self-organizing process that uses integration to create well-being within and between. And they'd go, what? And I'd say, well, let me use one example. Consciousness in all the different forms of therapy or, you know, meditation practice or like yoga or Tai Chi, Qigong, centering prayer, mindful awareness practices, walking, sitting, all of them involve consciousness. Even parenting involves consciousness. Education involves consciousness. Anytime you're trying to help someone change, you know, you need them to be conscious. So what would happen if you took that finding and then said, okay, what would happen if we took integration as health, consciousness indeed for change, and help people try to integrate consciousness? I said, let's do that. Here's a table. Imagine the glass center of this table is the knowing of consciousness, the experience of being aware. Imagine the rim of this table, which is a wood rim, is actually representing the known. So on this graph, you can see there's the first five senses, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching. You can move a spoke of attention, these are the things that hold the table up, and imagine moving it over to the second segment of the rim. In science, we call the interior signals of the body the sixth sense. And then if you want to just keep the numbers going, first five, six, go to the next segment of the rim is the seventh sense. That's a sense of mental activities, feelings, thoughts, memories, things like that. And then move it over yet again to the final segment of the rim, the eighth sense. So we would do this as a reflective practice. I would do this with kids just as a drawing. And what it did was the hub of knowing could be differentiated from the rim of the knowns, and you could systematically link them with the movement of this metaphoric spoke of attention. So attention is that process which directs energy and information flow. Awareness is a subjective experience of knowing. And so patients would start getting better from trauma, from anxiety, from mild to moderate depression. All sorts of things would start to change when they did this practice. So I started teaching it to my students, therapists, you know, and their clients would get better. So then I decided I would, you know, start doing it in workshops, and people would have pretty powerful experiences. So I recorded those experiences when I'd done it systematically with 10,000 people, recorded the results when they offer their first person accounts. And in trying to make sense of that 10,000 person study, what I did was I went to the world's experts on energy and on time, by the way, physicists. And I spent a week with 150 physicists and just asked them over and over again, what is energy? What is energy? And if you go to the next slide, you'll see this is a visual depiction I drew of the general thing that they said to me and then elaborated a lot. But the bottom line is this: what a physicist, many physicists will tell you energy is it's, and this is a little weird, I know, but it's the movement from possibility to actuality. And I would go, what? And they go, yeah, yeah. Energy is really the movement of possibility to actuality through a series of probabilities. And some physicists call that a probability distribution curve. So I mapped it out with subjective mental experience on the top, neural firing on the bottom. We're not going to look at the neural firing in this moment, but you can map it out, and I'm working with some neuroscientists on that. But here's what I want to say about this is this map helps really explain the metaphor of the wheel of awareness through a mechanism of the physics of energy. And if we go to the next slide, what I want to do is give you just a brief overview of what was found in this study. One is it was just universal findings. It didn't matter the person's educational background, language, meditation history, profession, gender, race, nationality. It just didn't matter. You know, besides the accents you would hear and the translations you'd hear, when you see the transcription of what is said, you can't tell who this person is who's having the experience. People would feel a shift in their relationship with others and the self. They would experience over time a reduction in chaos and rigidity. But here's the amazing thing. If you go back two slides just to the wheel of awareness, when people get to the seventh sense and explore mental activities, they can then bend the spoke of attention around before we move to the final relational sense, our sense of connection to others, and bend that spoke around to explore the hub itself. So if you go to the slide of the plane of possibility, what appears to be happening is that the hub, this metaphor for the knowing, has these qualities. If you go now to our slide with the words, with the quotes, people, when they bent the spoke around, would say, I have this incredible feeling of clarity, joy, expansiveness, the infinite, eternity, God, love, peace, a sense of being a fundamental part of the whole, connected to others, the world, and the universe. They would talk about being in this timeless state that as people practice the wheel, because we distribute it from our website, they email us and let us know they continue to have, not every time, it's not there all the time, but this is my daily practice, you get this access to this spaciousness. And the issue is what's going on there? What's going on there? So I think what's going on there, and this is with 100 question marks preceding it and following it, but it's a hypothesis that's generated from this first person study that comes to second person data that now we're translating to a third person scientific proposal. Here's the proposal. Let's go back a slide. That the knowing of consciousness may, and I underscore may, come when the energy position is in this plane of possibility. And that as you move up along that probability distribution curve, let's say to a plateau, you're describing what an intention is, or what a mood is, or a state of mind. And in those particular states, you have particular peaks that can arise. So you can get, if you will, thinking would be just beneath the peak, and a thought would be the peak there. If you look at that plateau on the left, let's say I'm in a shame state, I'll have particular thinking that tells me I'm a no good person, and a thought, I'm a jerk. I could have memories about all the things I've done wrong. That would be just beneath the peak. But then the peak is, you know, there, you made a big mistake, buddy. Or I might say, it's not worth living. So there's this process beneath the peak of a feeling, and then the feeling of despair as a peak. So this very simple graph, it may be complicated at first, but even at this conference I'm at here, I arrived and someone met me in the elevator. He goes, Dan, I've been in my plane of possibility, and now seeing you, I know it's a peak I'm really enjoying. You know, and every time I see him, for some reason, I keep on seeing him. I'm referring to where he is on this graph. It's kind of fun. Once you get used to it, you can use it to describe
all sorts of aspects of mental life. In clinical work, it's profoundly helpful to understand trauma, or, you know, this way in which we get lost in basically a plateau and we need to work with people to get down to the plane. But here's the thing that's so intriguing. Your plane and my plane, this infinite, are basically the same. So it's in this plane of possibility where we reach down into infinity. It's actually where time disappears. And I talk about this a lot in mind, but I'll just say there's a reason to see that a sense of what's called an arrow of time or directionality of change doesn't exist in the plane, where you, as on plateaus and peaks, you do have this directionality of change. Like you can't uncrack an egg. You know, it's at a different plane, a different level of experience that we can talk about maybe in the Q&A. But here, let me just say, this maps on beautifully. And if you go to the next slide too, the slide after the one of describing things, the in-group, out-group distinction thing, this graph helps us understand that even though we have an evolution of in-group versus out-group distinctions, and we can have this reactivity of no and receptivity of yes, and here I am in Washington, D.C., and you can feel it, you can palpate it on the streets, you know, this incredible in-group, out-group distinction going on. And there's a lot of this reactivity of fight, flee, freeze, or even for many of us, faint, you know, out of helplessness. And what I want to suggest to you is one way we can go about this, and I'll be meeting with different groups to kind of work on this, you know, is if people can access the plane of possibility, what I'm suggesting to you is that it helps us understand the research that shows that mindfulness practices and loving kindness practices have been shown in research paradigms to decrease in-group, out-group distinctions, to decrease implicit racial bias. That's just an amazing finding. So yes, we have work to do in therapy. We can work along all those nine domains of integration. But if we go to the next slide on self, singular noun, or plural verb, I just want to close with just a couple of general statements about, you know, where we are at as citizens on this planet. Whatever country we're in, you know, whatever profession we're in, whatever roles in life we're in, I just want you to consider this. You know, the languaging we do, the words we have, like this word self, you know, it's been equated with the body, you know. So I was teaching the other day, my mom, it was in her 80s, she came to my lecture, and I said, look, you know, my mom, like lots of moms, they call you by a name. They say, Danny, you're this, you're that. And so I really identified this body I'm in as myself, right? And even though they're very, you know, socially minded and stuff like that, still the word self gets equated with the body at home with loving parents. And our modern society, it gets perpetuated with school. It even has been perpetuated for 2,500 years in science, you know, and then even society with media says the self is a singular noun. Self is separate. Now, Einstein called that an optical delusion of our consciousness. It's also an optical delusion of our culture, our modern culture. Maybe not every culture, but our modern culture. We don't have a sense of belonging, you know? We don't have a sense of deep connection where we realize other people are us. That trees and the clouds, they are us. This planet is an extension of your body, if you will. So if you think that the self might be a plural verb, you know, what would that mean? If we go to the next slide, you come to these questions of the interrogatives, you know, where is your mind? What would an integrated self be? You know, what would that be like? So what I want to suggest to you is that, you know, where your mind is within you and between you. You know, what your mind is in part, it's an emergent property of energy and information flow. This is the what. And it's a self-organizing process. That takes us to the how. How does the mind work in well-being and unwell-being? Well, when it's integrating, it produces that incredible flow of harmony. But when it doesn't, it goes to chaos or rigidity, like you're seeing on the planet today. all the rigid stances people take, all the chaos that you're feeling every time you wake up and listen to the news. We're in a state of massive assault on integration around this planet. So we've done the where, the what, we've done the how, we can even say the when. The mind is both without any sense of time. I think that's the pure state of awareness. But the things you're aware of, like these bodies that move around, yeah, there's an arrow of time, a directionality of change. Okay, so you're now, but part of you may have this sense of timelessness. I'll tell you, when I wrote this book, Mind, and got deeply into the study of time, I finally understood what I was feeling since I was a little kid, that sometimes I feel timeless, and sometimes I feel time-bound. And that's because you have these ways that you can understand that scientifically. So that's the when. And then we have now the who and the why. And let's finish up with that. The who I want to suggest to you is a crucial question. You know, when we start with the why of those two, we could say, if you are truly a self-organizing process, we want to be very, very humble about this and very, you know, careful about saying it, because no one wants to tell anyone else about what the why is, why you're here, what's the purpose of you being here, that kind of thing. But here's a suggestion from this line of reasoning, and it's, again, with 100 question marks before. If we are a part of self-organization, the why of self-organization is to create harmony through integration. So you can say, well, the why of why I'm here is to be an integrator, to try to find chaos and rigidity where it's there, if I'm a therapist or a parent or a teacher or just a citizen. I mean, just like, or as a citizen on the planet, you know, to create more integration, which creates more well-being, honoring differences, promoting compassionate linkages. That's the why of it. Then if you do the who, you can say, well, at one level, I'm a conduit of experience, you know, and I'm also a constructor. And that's great. You're both those things. But where is the conduition happening? Where's this flow happening? And where is the construction happening? And then we'll go to the second to last slide. And this is where I want to suggest to you that an integrated self, putting all those six interrogatives together into one three-letter word in English, we're doing this in different languages, but you know, when we go to different countries, but mui means you honor the differentiated me in your body. And you say, I gotta give this body good exercise, good food. I gotta enjoy this body. I wanna sleep this body well. This body has a history I wanna really understand in a coherent way. That's beautiful. That's me. Never need to get rid of that differentiated me. But equally important, just differentiated state, is identity as a we. So you don't wanna give up me to get we. But it's, how can you be one integrated self? Not homogenous. Integration is not about blending. It's about honoring differences and maintaining differences, but linking them together. So you can have an integrated identity as a mui, M-W-E, a differentiated me, differentiated we. And imagine what the world would be like if we could offer kids in our modern society an opportunity to get away from what looks like is a lethal lie. That the self is a singular, separate now. The self is separate. That's not only making people unhappy, but it's making the brain vulnerable to a sense of isolation and just treating the planet like a trash can and treating other people just like objects. And so on our last slide, we come to this fundamental way of putting this all together. You say, look, from a neuroscience summit point of view, that the mind can create ultimately drives kindness and compassion. And when we see it that way, then we realize you put all the neuroscience together, all the relational science together, all the spiritual traditions together, and you can dissolve the boundaries between spiritual wisdom and scientific knowledge. And that is a world together, working together, we can create. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
And Dan, thank you so much. As always, you covered quite a lot of ground. That was quite a journey.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And sorry for the technical thing. Should I turn my camera back on or is that going to goof it up?
No, I think we should stay with the audio only.
Okay, great.
Now, this is your chance if you're a viewer and you're participating now and want to ask a question to Dan. You can type in a question in the dialog box that's right under the video player and hit submit, and your question will come directly to me here in the Sounds True studio. We've already received quite a few questions from people, Dan, as they were listening. And I wanted to start off because a couple of the questions are right in this territory, which is people wanting to make integration real in their lives. I mean, here you said integration is the basis of health. So I want to increase my level of integration. And it seemed like there were two methods, if you will, that you pointed to in your talk, at least two. One had to do with mindful awareness practice, and we have a couple of questions about that. And then also developing, cultivating healthy relationships. Before we move to our questions, tell me if there are other approaches, if you will, that I can bring into my life so I can be more integrated.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, yes, there are. So the notion is that when there's chaos or rigidity in your life that is prolonged, not just like for, you know, a minute, but it's actually staying with you for hours and hours and hours, or, you know, it's repeating itself in a pattern that really feels it's shoving you into chaotic states or rigid states, that's just kind of a signal that invites you to say, okay, there's a particular aspect of my life that's not integrated. And there are nine domains, and each domain of integration has things you can do in that domain. So the ones you mentioned, Tammy, are, you know, consciousness integration would be, I think, what mindfulness practices are. And then the second domain you referred to is interpersonal integration. And there's a way of making sure that people in, let's say, a one-on-one relationship, a romance, for example, you know, are people allowed to be differentiated in this romance, you know, whether it's sexually or just, you know, socially or attachment-wise, there's all sorts of layers of relationship. And, you know, you may find, in fact, this very simple approach helps you improve the nature of your relationship. But then there are seven other domains of integration, and, you know, this would just take another hour to go through, but so in the book Mindsight, you know, I go through in detail an example of each of the nine domains so that you can see there's, you know, interpersonal neurobiology is not a form of therapy. It's just really a way of informing therapy of all sorts, but it's a way of really a framework for understanding reality and life. So you can use, there's very practical tools you can use. And I would recommend either the Mindful Therapist book, which goes through this, or probably the most practical book is a book called Brainstorm, which teaches adolescents how to integrate their lives within and between. So there's a lot of specifics, and, you know, we could get into it if you want, but I think that's a good general place to start.
Okay, without going into all of the other seven domains, I'm curious, though, are there a couple of practical suggestions you could give to people outside of the relationship sphere and the mindful awareness consciousness sphere?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll give you an example. But again, you'd want to really understand what that domain is to then naturally see what you would do. But I'll give you an example. You know, one would be bilateral integration. These days in the field of neuroscience, you know, if you're a card-carrying neuroscientist, which many of my colleagues are, you are not supposed to say that there's much difference between the left and the right side of the brain. And there's heated debates where people are incredibly dismissive of this. But when you look at the science, and I recently reviewed the current science, but even if you look at the past, you know, 100 years of science, there's lots of reason to believe for millions of years, millions and millions of years, vertebrates have had very different left and right functioning in their nervous systems. And you can show clinically that there are people who actually have found a way to not differentiate those two and then not link them. So one simple example would be this. About 20% of the population, I believe, has what's called dismissing attachment. That's a formal category in attachment research. And they, in my point of view, having done this for 25 years, have a left mode dominance and a right mode lack of development in their way of being both with themselves and with other people. So a very practical thing for that 20% of the population
is to offer them not a way to kind of retrieve memories of the past, which they really can't get at, but rather to give them an opportunity to see that they're living with half a brain. And, you know, there's a case of Stuart, a 92-year-old, where you can see his progress to, in a very, very gentle way, invite him to show, to experience a little bit of his right mode, which what would that include? It would include tuning into nonverbal signals of others and himself. It would include being aware of the interiority of his body signals. It would be autobiographical memory, you know, self and time. And in doing this, you'll see what he does is he starts activating circuits that have been dormant for literally about 90 years. And as he does, his left mode, which is very literal, logical, linear, all these things that begin with the left, with an L, you know, what you'll see is this unfolding of an amazing journey into being more integrated. And as Stuart said, the sense of joy and well-being that emerged after this work, he couldn't believe he could ever experience in his life before he passed away. So integration gives rise to joy, basically. It's a source of creativity. It isn't that creativity comes from the left or the right. It's actually coming from integration. So I agree with the neuroscientists. Let's not oversimplify and say the right is creative, the left is intellectual. That's not true. But there are some truths that are being buried now because you're not supposed to talk about these differences. This would be one example. And where attention goes, neural firing flows and neural connection grows. So what you do is you focus attention on right mode processes that are underdeveloped, let them grow and develop, and then connect to the left mode processes. And you can do this in a very gentle, loving, systematic way that transforms people's lives.
Okay, Dan, we got a lot of questions coming in, so we'll see if we can cover some of them.
Sure.
David wrote in, I try to focus my attention for 20 to 50 minutes per day to boost my awareness with the goal of being aware most of the day. I mostly fail, however. So how can I overcome this and change my neuro pathways?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think the idea of, being mindfully aware is different from just being aware. So, David, I don't know if you're saying I'm trying to be, you know, very present for what's happening and not getting lost, or if you mean you're getting distracted. So if you just mean literally I get distracted a lot and it's hard to stay present, then I would, you know, suggest that you look at, there's a wonderful book by Lydia Zlowska called, you know, A Mindful Prescription. And it isn't just for people with attention problems, but it just teaches you the basic steps that we've shown in our research center at UCLA in a pilot study can strengthen attention. So if you just mean I get distracted a lot, that's pretty straightforward. If you mean instead that being aware that it's hard to have this kind of spacious awareness that includes both tapping into whatever's going on, like you're going for a walk, so you want to feel the wind on your skin, on your cheeks, and you want to feel the bottoms of your feet and go for a mindful walk, but instead, you know, you find yourself putting on a book on tape or you're busy thinking about work. Okay, then that's something you can work on where the sensory systems of the bottoms of your feet or the feelings of your cheek, those are these side sensory circuits, and you do want to strengthen those. And research out of Toronto shows what mindfulness training does is it strengthens your capacity to distinguish sensation, which is a side part of the brain, two sides, versus the internal mental chatter, which is more the midline where you're worried about others and the self. So what I would do is go back it up and try just 1 minute a day, 2 minutes a day of breath awareness practice. You can do this from our website or really any of these wonderful websites that are out there. Just start with basic breath practice. Make sure you do it every day, kind of like brushing your teeth. Go from 2 minutes to 3 minutes. Just extend it a little bit every week until you get stronger and stronger. Basically, what you're doing, there's three different circuits I won't mention here, but you're mentioning strengthening the circuitry. One is sustaining attention. The next is the part of your brain that notices I'm not doing what I intended to do. And then the third part is I'm redirecting to what I want to do. So those are actually three different circuits that you can identify, and literally they get stronger. So if you try to jump too fast, like do really, really long meditations or something like that, you may get so discouraged with yourself that you won't just do these basic breath practices first. So I would strengthen attention first and then move into more opening ones. We've had really good luck with that sequence where people do the breath practice first, you know, for a month or two, then they go onto the wheel and they feel very grounded in that whole thing. And if they don't want to do the whole 20-minute wheel, they can do 5-minute segments at a time. So I would try that, David. I think, you know, studies show that, you know, you keep at it and you'll find that there are changes that happen, but just do it at the rate that feels right for you.
Talking about the wheel of awareness, Dan, that you introduced, Dwight writes in, can you help me apply, and Dwight writes, can you help me apply the wheel of awareness in daily life?
Yeah. Thank you for the question, Dwight. You know, the way to think about it is like this. We have a lot of beliefs and what are called mental models that you can think of as those plateaus that give rise to certain thinking. And when we're up on those peaks of thought or feeling or remembering, we don't even have a perspective that we're lost in this imprisoned plateau area. So when we're getting to the plane of possibility, what you want to do is, when you do the wheel practice, get the feeling of what it's like to be in the plane that's the hub and just being able to move that spoke around a different place on the rim. So let me give you an example of how you might use this in everyday life. You know, I'm actually writing a book on the wheel of awareness. So some friends lent me their house on the coast in California. I was going through small towns. You know, there was a speed limit of 55. I was going at 55, no problem. And then suddenly the speed limit dropped to 25 so fast that, you know, you had to slam on the brakes to slow down. So it was a speed trap. Anyway, this cop puts on his red light behind me. I really didn't feel like getting a ticket. But he pulls me over. So I go to my hub. Now, what does that mean? On my rim, I've got, oh my God, this is ridiculous. What a speed trap. And I was watching the speed anyway. I should tell this officer, this is ridiculous. You know, I know it's a speed trap. You can't go from 55 to 25 that. Come on. You know, so that's all on my rim. And I go, you know something? That's going to get you nowhere. It'll probably get you a bigger ticket. So I drop into my hub, which is the plane of possibility, right? The officer pulls me over, comes over. You know, I roll down my window. I have my hands all on my steering wheel so I don't get shot or anything like that. And I say, hello, officer. He goes, you know, you're going fast there. I go, thank you for stopping me. And he looks at me like I'm nuts. I go, oh, you know, you were going fast. I go, oh, no, I was actually watching this speed limit, but okay, well, how fast was I going? He tells me I was going like, whatever, 47. He goes, but I'm going to mark it down to 35 so you can get the minimal, you know, fine that you can get. I said, thank you, officer. It's like this. But he looked at me like I was nuts. But that's an everyday application. I don't know if I hadn't been doing the wheel every day, you know, which I do, it's my daily practice, that I would have access to that plane of possibility, that hub. It's the same thing. The wheel is a metaphor. And so I could drop down there literally with red lights flashing. And I think the best outcome was what happened. Coming to life from the hub, from the plane of possibility, is a much better way to be, so that any kind of you know, peaks that arise, like what I had to say to the officer, comes from a place of equanimity, not from a place of reactivity. So that's an example. I'll give you an example from kids. We use this in kindergarten. And, you know, it's a drawing, not a meditation, but a kindergarten teacher wrote to us and said, you know, there was a kid who'd been expelled from one school. He entered her school. She teaches all her kids the, you know, wheel of awareness through this book called The Whole Brain Child. I wrote with Tina Bryson, so you can learn how to give it to kids. And so this young new kid in the classroom learned it. And about a week later, he came up to her and said, Mrs. Smith, you know, I'm lost on my rim. You got to give me a place to take a break because I'm about to punch that kid for taking my block. So she goes, okay, you know, Billy, you go over there, and that's good you didn't punch Sammy, that's great. So he goes there and he comes back to her and he says, okay, I'm back in my hub, I can go back on the playground. Now think about, this is a 5-year-old, just giving him a visual metaphor for this, you know, basically the plane of possibility opportunity he had, changed his life. And she wrote me months and months later and said, he's like a different kid from what was described the kid was like at another school. And this is where we want the whole world to become, you know, drop down so that when you see another person, whether it's a police officer or a little Sammy taking your block, you come up with the most skillful response, you know, and instead of, you know, shooting people or blowing people up or whatever we do, you know, you drop into this space where you realize we're all deeply interconnected. That's the idea of it. That's how you can use it in everyday life.
Dan, a woman named Wendy writes in, and whether you're talking about practicing the wheel of awareness or engaging in a mindfulness practice, you've talked about the power of being consistent. I mean, you mentioned just now that you do the wheel of awareness practice pretty regularly.
Yeah.
So Wendy's question is just how much practice is needed and how long does each session need to be in order for lasting change to occur?
It's a great question, Wendy. And, you know, since I just met with the world's top scientist on this question, I'm going to give you a response that will probably surprise everyone. The first response is to say, you know, we just don't really know exactly how much. That's number one. Number two, I'm going to give you some numbers that are kind of surprising. The first thing to say is that a number of the researchers were saying that it's better to be doing something than nothing. And because people are so busy and hard to commit, let's say, to half an hour a day, it's better if they do 3 minutes a day or 5 minutes a day. That everyone agreed regular is better than saying, okay, I'll do my hour on the weekend and not do anything. So in that sense, it's probably reasonable, although people don't like when I say this, it's probably reasonable to compare it to brushing your teeth. You know, you can brush your teeth 2-3 minutes a day or twice a day, like say, for 5 minutes total, you know, and you don't want to wait till the weekend to brush your teeth. No. You don't want to do that. You want to get in the habit of just doing this. So, you know, other researchers would say, well, some studies suggest you want a minimum of 12 minutes a day. So just remember that with the daily dozen. And, you know, other people push for 20, but the research really is looking at a 12-minute a day minimum. So for myself, I make sure I do 12 minutes a day, a daily dozen. But the wheel is about 20 minutes. I have a regular mindful movement practice. I alternate and do that too. That's about 15, 20 minutes, you know. So somewhere between 12 and 20, if you can get that in every day, you know, I think you'd be on really, really solid ground. Other people would say, no, don't say that, Dan. Let them do 2 minutes a day. Yeah, start with 2 minutes a day. But, you know, I think the research is proposing get regular, and then get it up to about a dozen. You know, I think that's a minimum you want to aim for. But if you do 20, that's probably better.
Okay, Dan, we have a question here from Cecilia, who writes, I'm curious if there has been research on the effects of relational listening on neural integration. From what I've seen, using a relational listening tool for myself is that I'm more flexible in my thinking and in my ability to respond thoughtfully and reflexively in any given situation. Is there any research related to this?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question. The one thing, it's not about neural integration per se, but there's a great study from about 5 years ago on relational listening in terms of empathy and providing empathic feedback and improvement in immune function for patients who go for a common cold, and they get over their cold a day sooner if the physician is being empathic. There might be such research that's emerging in these coordinated EEG studies that are being done, but I can't quote them right now on the top of my head. But it's a great question, and I would say this, that when you look at loving kindness practices, one of just where you're just within you, just imagining being kind to either people in general. For example, a study in 2004 in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences by Antoine Lutz and colleagues. What they showed was you get more gamma waves, which is a functional sign of integration. You get more gamma waves in those studies than in any other condition. So there's something about compassion and about integration that I would imagine if you could do, it's much more difficult to do dyadic listening, you know, two people listening to each other, you would show that they are really able to resonate together, and I'll bet it would promote integration. You know, in our field, attachment, I mean, that's been demonstrated. When you have the outcomes of integration, at least, the brain isn't usually studied, but, you know, when there's, you know, receptive parenting going on, you do have a child developing the outcomes of integration,
And when that receptivity is not there with developmental trauma, as I mentioned, you have massive assaults on neural integration. So those are pointing in the direction that your question is asking. Does being open to each other relationally lead to increased integration? And there's fingers pointing there. We want to have more definitive stuff, but it looks like that's the case.
A woman named Barb writes, Dan, she says, I'm thinking of the last slide and wondering if it's possible to work from the bottom up as well as the top down, i.e., would the active practice of kindness and compassion enhance further integration of the brain?
I think that's absolutely true. And if you look at, I don't know if this is Barb Fredrickson, but if you look at Barb Fredrickson's work, inspired by Sharon Salzberg, as well as other people's work on loving kindness meditation, the answer is yes. Yeah. And, you know, in a way, there's some fabulous studies or proposals about the nature of consciousness itself building on the social circuitry of the brain. So I think there's an exciting moment we're at, you know, of looking at how awareness and relationality are not separate functions in the brain. So when relationships can be generated, you know, through loving kindness practices, even within you, so you don't need to be interacting with another person, you're doing it using the social circuitry of your brain to imagine those wishes of kindness and care for others, it's exactly activating the circuitry both of awareness and integration. So, yeah, and that's why, you know, we're really in this amazing moment to start teaching this in schools and having people do it as a regular integrative practices, basically.
Okay, Dan, just two more questions, one from the audience and then a final one from me. Yay. Beverly writes in, how does the framework of integration help us understand ADD and ADHD?
Yeah, you know, there are difficulties with areas of the anterior cingulate. That is a very integrative area of the brain, that it's not keeping things as strongly in what's called working memory, working along with the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So there's a lot of evidence that attention deficit disorder has some challenges to integration. And what we were hoping to do in our study was try to create more signs of integration in the brain, which would be more stable attention. So that was our study headed by Lydia Zlowska that I mentioned. But even in other conditions, you know, not related to attention like mood disorders, David Miklovitz at UCLA is really trying out how you can use mindfulness to try to get more integrative functions that lead to stabilization of mood in people with manic depressive illness. So it's an exciting moment to actually use mind training practices to stream energy and information flow through the brain to stabilize attention with people with attention troubles, stabilize mood with people with mood regulation issues. And it's an incredible moment in our whole field, a field of clinical work, science, spirituality, just an amazing moment. And so great question. And Lydia Zlowska's book for attention is something I would look at.
And Dan, just as a final question, I'm sensitive to the fact that right now you're in Washington, D.C. You're there for a conference.
Yes.
And being in Washington, D.C. today, there's so much news that's breaking and so much concern about people not being able to collaborate, if you will. And here you're talking about integration and honoring differences and promoting linkage. And I know that there's a huge social agenda, if you will, social change agenda, that is really underneath, if you will, all of the books that you write and the trainings that you offer. And I'm curious if you can just share a couple of thoughts of how you see the revolution in interpersonal neurobiology eventually making it, God willing, to our political life.
Yeah. Well, it's thank you, Tammy. Thank you. I'll just say a couple of things. You know, I've been asked to go to a government to speak to the prime minister and the parliament about certain things about where we're at in the world. And we're going to do the Wheel of Awareness practice because, you know, I think when governments can drop out of their plateaus of separateness and their peaks of, you know, certain rigid and chaotic thinking, that every human being has an opportunity to actually access this hub of the wheel, this plane of possibility, where they realize we're all so deeply interconnected, that we're kind of like these skin encased bodies or nodes in a much larger system, and that the system is the self. But in modern times, we've mistaken the body for the self. So I think that whole issue is, you know, it's a lie that's going to kill us if we don't emerge from it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, and I'll certainly do this when I go to this other country, but, you know, in terms of our country, you know, studies of what's called mortality salience or threat management show that when people feel under threat, whether it's for current things going on or historical things going on, or, you know, all sorts of things that can happen in the brain that makes you feel threatened, you know, when your brain tells you you're under threat, Steve Porges calls it neuroception. But when this neuroception of threat happens, we know from these mortality salient studies that the brain intensifies its in-group, out-group distinction. So, you know, what's going on here is, you know, the idea that we are in a place of great threat all around the world, that we have this evolved process by which we make in-group, out-group distinctions even higher. And then what goes on in this setting is we're not in the plane of possibility, right? We're lost in a plateau. So I think it's possible for human consciousness, both individually, for, of course, any citizen to have what Arthur Zients called pervasive leadership. Everyone could take this leadership, but especially for elected officials in parliament or prime ministers or presidents or, you know, Congress people, senators, you know, people in a position of making policy to have the experiential immersion in this more open space, where instead of just getting caught up in what we've evolved to have, which is to be in-group, out-group, distinguished people, what we can do instead is use consciousness to rise above our really evolutionary vulnerabilities to believe the lie that we're separate. And I believe in this so deeply that, you know, it's, as you're saying, you know, it's basically all of this science we've been trying to integrate into interpersonal neurobiology, and at our place, what we're trying to bring out into the world is the idea that cultural evolution happens by both changes in ideas, of course, but changes in consciousness. And one of those things is to say the self is not separate, that we are each other and we are nature. You know, and to have people fall in love with nature and fall in love with each other, to have that deep compassion, it's, I think, stronger than fear. I mean, you know, it's a trite thing to say, but this deep connectedness is a much stronger place than isolation and fear. So my hope, and it's, you know, we can only do what we can do, you know, in this world. But my hope is that by giving people the direct experience with the wheel of awareness, to give them access to the plane of possibility, then there's actually an opportunity for us to experience what an integrated identity feels like, a mui. And if we do that, I really feel very optimistic that we actually can move beyond our vulnerabilities and actually develop our strengths of compassion and kindness, and really have a sense of belonging to a much larger whole, not just now, but for generations to come. So this is a transition we need to go through. We're in a period of chaos or rigidity. Everyone seems to be getting mobilized. So let's use this chaos and rigidity we feel to actually motivate us and move into this new place.
Dan, thank you so much. Thank you so much for bringing your heart and your brilliance to the Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you.
My pleasure, Tammy. Thank you for all your wonderful work, and great to be here with you.
This concludes our 7th live session of the Neuroscience Training Summit. And thank you, everyone, for being with us. And thank you for your patience with our technical challenges and just having the audio feed here with Dan. I'm so glad that he was able to join us, even though he's not in his home location. Please note that the recording of this session will remain accessible and for free for 24 hours. If you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. Please join us, everyone, for our next live session. This is going to be an interesting one with Alexandra Katahakis, who will be talking about the neurobiology of sex addiction, and the movement towards eroticism. This will take place at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, for Sounds True, my name's Tammy Simon. Thanks for being with us. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. It's all about Mui.
Thanks, Tammy.
Thanks, Tammy.